She's Lauren Water, and yeah, her topic is what can it do for the public health.
So hello everyone, and thank you so much for being at this session today, especially given that it's one of the last sessions. I'm from the University of Guelph, which is about an hour west of Toronto, for those who might not be as familiar with Canadian geography. And today I'm going to be talking about conjoint analysis and the applications that I see for it within public health. Before I begin, I would just like to get a sense of how many of you have heard of conjoint analysis before. It can also be called discrete choice analysis. So just by a show of hands, how many of you have heard of it? So a handful. And how many of those who have heard of it have used it before? No one. Okay, great. So I'm very pleased about that. So no relationships to disclose today. So my objectives for today's session is that you're going to understand what conjoint analysis is. My real objective is that I'll be able to get you thinking about how you can apply it within your own public health research field. My ultimate objective is that you would actually go home and start using it, because I do think it's a really powerful tool to add to your arsenal that you might already be using. So my talk today is divided into three questions. The first question is, what problems in public health are we trying to address with conjoint analysis? What is conjoint analysis, and how can we use it to actually address this problem? So the problem in public health is that people make poor health decisions despite the public health interventions that we employ. And here I've shown two examples. We know that people often make poor eating choices. They choose to lead sedentary lifestyles. You can add your favorite public health problem in there. The list can go on and on. Even though we're doing a lot of great work to provide public health programs and services and education and so many interventions, sometimes they don't seem to make a lot of difference, particularly on a population level, about the decisions that people choose to make. We also know that changing behavior can be very difficult. And here I've shown the trans-theoretical model of behavior, sort of this idea that people have to go through multiple stages before they actually choose to change their behavior. And you can imagine that at any stage along that continuum, people can go off track, right? They either aren't thinking about it, or they think about it and change their mind, or they act and 6 months later they stop, or whatever it might be. And so the actual act of changing behavior is difficult, even though that's something that we're all trying to do within public health. However, some people are much better at changing behavior than others. And here I've given a few examples of common businesses, and I probably should have put Starbucks up here as well if I had known how long the line was going to be waiting half an hour for your coffee. We know that certain companies are really good at convincing you to make bad decisions, right? We know that eating fast food is not good for us. We know that drinking pop isn't good for us. Many people understand that smoking also isn't good for you either, but they still continue to make these choices, and oftentimes those choices are driven by fantastic marketing campaigns by these companies. And one of the things that I think that they're doing that perhaps public health is not doing is that they know their consumers very, very well. And they think about who their target audience is, and they spend a lot of money getting to know who that audience actually is. Whereas in public health, we often know what's good for people, right? We know that they should be exercising more or eating better food or that kind of thing. We don't necessarily know them in the same way that those companies that I previously showed you know their consumers. And so I suggest that we need to know the people that we're serving beyond what is good for the health, for their health. We need to think more like Coca-Cola or McDonald's or Starbucks as well. One of the ways that these companies get to know their consumers is through a statistical method called conjoint analysis, which I'm going to actually play. It's about a 5-minute video. The video does a much better job at explaining what conjoint analysis is in a more engaging way. It's a whiteboard video, and their drawing skills are also much better than mine are as well. So I'm going to play it now, and then I'll continue.
Have you ever had to make a decision between two or more options, a situation where there are some things you like about one option and some things you like about the other? Of course you have. Now think of all the organizations out there trying to create successful products and services, not to mention sell them at just the right price. It's a complex, competitive world, and many managers are just making educated guesses about how best to appeal to consumers. Well, there's a proven approach for these product and service providers. It's called conjoint analysis. So what is conjoint analysis and what can it do for you? Conjoint analysis is a marketing insight technique for predicting how products you create or redesign should perform when taken to market. Companies win over consumers by putting in the right features and charging the right price. For example, smartphone manufacturers are packing more and more capabilities into these tiny devices with billions of dollars at stake to create the right combinations of features and price. Hotels and resorts fine-tune their facilities and service levels to appeal to specific target markets, such as business travelers or luxury vacationers. Consumer packaged goods companies tweak their packaging, flavors, and nutritional contents to appeal to new market segments and create successful line extensions. Now let's consider Jane, who works for a company that manufactures bazoogles. A rival company across town came out with a new bazoogle, and Jane's sales have gone in the wrong direction. Now she's got a crisis on her hands. Bazoogles can have 2 to 4 nozzles, large and small monitors, and varying levels of noise, joints, and whiffs. The problem is, there are thousands of combinations of features, and Jane needs to come up with the right combination at the right price to regain market share. Jane has some ideas that she could concentrate among samples of potential customers. She could describe potential resembles and ask potential customers to tell how much they would like to buy in each one. Of course, she doesn't have enough time, money, or customers to do enough of these concept tests. What she really needs is a smarter, more scientific way to test thousands of possible bazoogles to find the optimal one. That's where conjoint analysis comes in. To start, Jane does some research so she can listen to key attributes and levels of her and her competitors' bazoogles. For example, a bazoogle could have 3 nozzles, small monitor, high noise, and shoot out 30 joints per minute. Conjoint analysis software systematically combines the features from Jane's list to show competing bazoogles at different prices. Consumers simply pick one from each scenario, much like they do in the real world. You can see why it's often called discrete choice analysis. Across a sample of respondents, numerous combinations are shown, and the software keeps track of how often different features are chosen at different prices when offered on different bazoogles. Using statistical analysis, the software estimates the preference scores for each consumer in the sample. Combinations of features that are chosen a lot get high utility scores. In essence, conjoint analysis has taken a snapshot of each consumer's brain and derived a statistical model that quantifies the preferences that led them to choose different bazoogles and pay for them the way they do. It's almost like Jane has captured hundreds of virtual consumers with their decision-making rules within the software on her computer. She's now got a what-if market simulator that acts like a voting machine for bazoogles. She can specify any of thousands of potential bazoogles in her conjoint analysis software, and the virtual consumers will vote on those potential bazoogles versus her competitors. Better yet, if Jane knew something about the cost of manufacturing the features, the software could search all potential bazoogles to find the one that's likely to beat the competition and maximize profit. Most any time people face decisions among different options made up of conjoined features, you can develop key insights into consumer choice using conjoint analysis. As you can imagine, the potential applications are numerous. And if you want to make more than one...
I'm going to stop it there. So although this video is talking in a marketing context. You can think about, instead of thinking about a product, you can be thinking about your program or your service or your education campaign, right? So what features of that program are speaking to your target audience? Which ones should you be optimizing for your audience that you're trying to reach? And conjoint analysis can help you to determine what are driving people's decisions around health behaviors. So in my own work at the University of Guelph, we actually applied conjoint analysis already in three different areas. We worked with our local health unit to look at how people assign importance to different aspects of community well-being. So we looked at ideas of healthy populations, democratic engagement, education, and which one of these did people feel were the most important to their well-being so that they could understand sort of how to target certain programs and services. We also worked with public health inspectors looking at their information technology services. They were interested in revamping the system that they were using, but they weren't exactly sure what changes that they needed to make. And so we used conjoint analysis to help them quantify the preference that their workers had for different information technology features to help them design the most optimal system for their workers. The last example that I can share is we were also working with public health inspectors who were interested in revamping their professional development framework. And so they use a competency-based framework as part of their professional development program. They have over 100 competencies. I wasn't involved in writing those statements. However, they weren't really sure which competencies should be targeted first. Which ones were considered most important to their workers that needed training right away. And so we use conjoint analysis in that scenario to help them understand which competencies they should target for professional development first, to help them maximize their limited resources that they already have. And I'm sure and I hope that as you were watching that video, the wheels have already begun to spin for yourself about how you could be optimizing your programs or services that you work with. Just from a sort of more statistical method perspective, the way that choices are converted into sort of quantified preferences is using hierarchical Bayesian analysis. This is a really powerful statistical method which actually allows you to estimate preferences at the individual level, not just at the population level like you often get with a regression model where it's more at the aggregate level. With hierarchical Bayesian, you can actually get right down to the individual level estimation. The reason it's called hierarchical is that there are two levels to the model. In your upper level, you're describing preferences using a multivariate normal distribution. And at the lower level, you're estimating the probability that they're going to make a certain choice based on their underlying preferences that you're trying to estimate, which are your beta values in your regression model. And then you use an MCMC procedure to iteratively estimate your model parameters for individual respondents, which can be really powerful, particularly if you're working with a very specialized target population to understand what certain individuals are thinking about and prefer in relation to public health. So I've mentioned some of the applications that I have worked on myself, but some of the ones that you might be thinking about are creating more effective messages. So there was actually a session earlier today where they used conjoint analysis in nutritional messaging to understand what about the message was actually speaking to their target population. It can help you to design better programs and services for particular target groups that you work with. Understanding what people prefer or value at a more granular level. I think oftentimes in public health, I'm sure all of you have employed Likert scales at one point or another. There are lots of problems that come with Likert scales. For example, translating preference into a number can be a problem. The way that people use the number scale can differ by culture or by age or just by understanding. Oftentimes people will use the scale differently. We'll see a lot of people kind of lump themselves at one end of the scale, so you don't get a lot of granular information in that way. And another thing is we often tend to think about Likert data is continuous, and we do means and standard deviations and t-tests when really it's actually ordinal data, which is a bit of a problem as well. And so conjoint analysis is actually a really great alternative to Likert scales that can help you to still understand how people prefer or value or consider certain issues without running into those problems with Likert data. The final one is just understanding and influencing why people make the choices that they do, and then making decisions around how you're designing your programs or services based on understanding your consumers or your target audience a lot better. So with that, I'd like to thank you for your attention and welcome any questions in the remaining time that we have. Yeah, so the question was, how large of a sample size do you need? It depends on, I guess, what the size of the population that you're trying to extrapolate to, as any sample size calculation does. With conjoint analysis, because you can get down to the individual level, if you can accept a higher level of variability, you can do it with small groups. It's been done on one person before, if that's a really valuable person that you need to understand. Sort of the guidelines around sample size, you're typically looking at sort of 300 plus to get your variability down. But it really depends on how much variability you're willing to accept for your estimate.
So this analysis can handle the situation where you have more covariates than the observation?
It struggles a little bit with that. With Bayesian analysis, it is a little bit better than with typical regression analysis, thinking about model convergence and that kind of thing, because you are iteratively estimating based on your upper level model. But that is still an issue. The number of parameters, you can't just estimate lot of parameters. Yeah. So with sample size, that would come into that as well, the number of features or items that you're trying to estimate.
I only know a little bit about the discrete choice analysis experiments for the reason that I find to do a project.
Great.
But I was a little bit lost on sample size calculation in the building off of the last week.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about the sample size calculation method?
Mm-hmm. So the question was still around sample size. Unlike sort of more traditional sort of regression analyses, there aren't very well specified sample size calculations that have been published for discrete choice analysis. So a lot of the literature that I've read, it's more guidelines for sample size as opposed to sort of rigorous calculations that you might employ when you're estimating regression, like a linear regression model. Some of the sort of sample size estimates are, again, thinking about the number of parameters that you're trying to estimate, how large your sort of the target population is that you're deriving your sample from, and that sort of thing. So, yeah, that's sort of the best that I have. I can send you some literature if you'd like afterwards as well.
What's the difference between the model that you mentioned and the multi-level mixed effect model using the logistic regression?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's technically you're using very similar to that. So just the name is, maybe marketing people, they like to have a new name which looks different, but technically you're not doing much, using except, assuming that the parameters, the coefficients are having, the following distribution using the Bayesian approach. You can use anything else.
Mm-hmm.
So technically, multi-level mix effect model, we assume that the parameter technically are random variables, we have a specific distribution. And there are some techniques that even if you look at that sample size that I mentioned, for multi-level model, depending on the level, and depending on the system, some people use even different type after they get the results, we use the multi-level model, like for example, in HIV, we use a different time point, and then we use patient data from patient test, and the level two, and the time points, like you know, after baseline, after 6 months, would be level one, and then different clinics treating the patient level three, and so on and so forth. So all sample size dissemination depends on those factors, and what type of, you know, you might use the step weight, you know, the trial or crossover or whatever to get your data. It all depends on different type of methods. Or you might use cluster randomization, which has using different type of sampling techniques. You have to specify your arms, and you know, you have to see how many you know, cluster you need to reach 80% power.
Right.
And simulation, you can always do it.
Just wanted to mention that, but this technically is a Bayesian version of, you know, the multi-level model.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sort of the idea with the hierarchical Bayesian model versus multi-level modeling, regression modeling, they would be very similar if you have non-informative priors for your Bayesian analysis. So then in that case, they are quite similar. However, if you have information about the population that you're interested in prior to your study, you can use more informative priors to help you estimate your model parameters, which you wouldn't be able to do with multi-level modeling. So I think that's probably the main difference between the two.
Okay, we'll take one more question. Ma'am, you had a question, right?
Yeah, I have a question. I'm really sorry, but I'll answer anyway. I was wondering, in the case where you have covariates that that are different than the covariates you're explicitly testing, that you don't know what they are, I just wonder if there is a simple way of understanding if there are extra covariates that are affecting the process.
Right. So the question is, can you understand if there are other factors that you didn't measure which are not being explained by the model that you are estimating? Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. So with conjoint analysis, you are limited by the fact that you can only understand what you've measured, because the choices that you're asking people to make are specific to the items or variables that you're showing them, right?
So maybe I can explain that question a little bit better. So for example, those images that you were showing at the end, like the ad, I don't know exactly what your mechanism is, but what I'm picturing is like when you put two ads in front of someone and say, how much does this make you not want to vote, or something like
right.
that. You know, there's a lot of things in there, and you might be interested in how does the lighting affect them, how does the color scheme affect them, how does the font affect it. But you might not consider that, like, the race of the person in there is affecting it, or any of the number of other factors. And I guess I'm just wondering about that and how you understand that.
Right. You are limited, so. You are limited by sort of what you've specified that you want to measure before you actually start testing how people are making their choices. So there wouldn't be a way to understand if there was another factor that's explaining the choices that they make, because you haven't specified that within your model. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Laura.
Thank you.